Bruce Pratt here with us to talk about, well, one of the great rivalries in sports, and certainly here in the East, a rivalry that gets overlooked.
Yeah, you know, and what's interesting about this, I think most people would answer these questions the following way. Who do Red Sox fans consider their greatest rivals? The New York Yankees. Who do the Boston Bruins fans consider their greatest rivals? Montreal Canadiens, right? Historically true. The Celtics, I'd say it's the Lakers or the Sixers,
yeah.
If you look over any period of time. The Patriots becomes a little different. And I would say it's Indianapolis until they started to fail, but they really haven't had any strong rivals within their own division for a long time. But I suppose over time, probably the Colts have provided the most challenge to them, especially in the Peyton Manning era. Now, what's interesting is that's Boston and four other towns. Right? Now, in New York, where you can choose from two teams in any of the four major sports, you know, some Mets fans consider the Yankees their biggest rivals just because it's for attention, it's for the back page of the paper or whatever. But what's really interesting to me is that rarely is it a city against a city in more than one sport. And there was a time in the 60s and 70s when Kansas City and Oakland had exactly that. Now, people will not think of the Kansas City Scouts, Oakland Seals rivalry as being very big. But certainly the Chiefs and the Raiders and the Royals and the A's were a sustained, bitter, acrimonious rivalry stoked by some interesting characters.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, and of course, with that A's rivalry is because the Kansas City A's became the Oakland A's.
Exactly. And Charlie Finley lied and postured and did a million things to make everybody angry. And, you know, Ewing Kauffman came in and brought the A's to Kansas City as a philanthropic venture. He never really expected to make any money, and he lost his shirt. Okay, so we have these, we remember the great battles between the Chiefs and the Raiders, and we remember the A's and the Royals in these series. But here's what we don't think about a lot, which is very different than those of us who are Boston or New York centric. We've had teams in those cities forever. Okay, I mean, you know, as long as it's been professional baseball, there have been a team or two in Boston. Same thing with us. Now, Kansas City and Oakland were teams with no major leagues when they both decided they needed baseball. So Oakland poached KC's team, and Kansas City could not compete to lure someone like the Giants or the Dodgers or the Cardinals to their city, so they had to get an expansion team. And this occurred at the same moment, essentially, that the AFL and NFL were heading toward that merger.
Right.
Now, if you can think of any two teams that are more different in when they first begin to meet each other, than the Kansas City Chiefs and the Oakland Raiders, it's hard to imagine. The Kansas City Chiefs were Hank Stram, button down, no sideburns, no beards. Everybody looks the same. Everybody acts the same. And they had 1 year of glory, and after that, not so much. The Raiders, on the other hand, as somebody said, the difference was that the Raiders, that the Kansas City came at you in an organized kind of way, and the Raiders jumped through the skylight with a machine gun. And I'll find that quote later. But the cities changed. And the cities changed as a result of this. And one of the great questions we always ask ourselves is, do sports teams have an economic advantage? Do they bring an economic blessing to the towns they're in? That's not the answer to that is not always clear, especially when, you know, public funds are used for huge stadiums, when old neighborhoods are torn down, when people are displaced, when areas are marginalized, when highways built to these stadiums cut neighborhoods off. There can be a lot of downside to that. The Oakland Alameda County Coliseum is still one of the most wretched places. I've been to a baseball game there 40 years ago. It was a dump then. The Raiders were there. They moved to Los Angeles. They moved back, and now they're moving to Las Vegas, right? So there's been that whole game going on. Kansas City, meanwhile, was fighting this image, and a very unfair image, of being ultra-Orthodox conservative town, which may be true of Missouri, may be true of Kansas, but was not necessarily true of Kansas City. In many ways, one of the birthplaces of jazz, one of the all-time great jazz places. But also, Kansas City was not just a cow town, and that's what it was portrayed as. And they believed the only way they could change that, the New York Times called it a cow town, Chicago called it a cow town, was to get a Major League Baseball team. So in 1955, when they got Kansas City A's from Philadelphia, that was a huge deal for them, a huge deal. That led to them getting a football team, to an NHL team, and it never worked, though their AHL team does pretty well today. And they never really had a great basketball tradition either. But there was that sense that Kansas City had arrived as soon as it had these teams. And then it also happened to be a city full of strikes. And through the 60s and 70s, the teachers struck twice. There was a huge construction strike. And it was very hard for the baseball teams to keep sort of, or for them to lure other teams, because people are going, yeah, you're going to build a new stadium. And then twice the stadium wasn't built in the year they said it was going to be, or ready the next year. What this book does is there are four major chapters, and they start with the A's and the Royals, then the Raiders and the Chiefs, and the A's and Royals, the Raiders and the Chiefs, and then add some stuff to the bad guy. Matthew Ehrlich is the author, and he's a professor emeritus of journalism at University of Illinois, and looks at all the components that go into the rivalry. One, the personalities behind them. Charlie Finley would do anything to make a buck and to stir up trouble, and most of his promotions failed, and everybody thinks of him as a failure, but let's do remember the designated hitter, damn you, is due to Charlie O. Finley, and that so other things had changed in baseball, the multicolored uniforms and the like. That's all got
facial
to do with
hair.
Yeah, facial hair. Well, and the thing that's really interesting is if you look at what happened when the Oakland A's got really good, when they had Rudy and Fingers and Jackson and Bando, I mean, you know, those great teams under Dick Williams, they were the antithesis of the Kansas City Royals. You know, George Brett couldn't grow a mustache, and they were the clean-looking, clean-cut kids who played on AstroTurf. And here are these wild men from Oakland. And that really, in things after ball four, he said, that's when baseball changed. He said, yes, when Messerschmitt and McNally finally got the reserve clause changed, that was a big deal. And Finley, because Finley lost all of his players to free agency as a result, and Catfish Hunter, he lost because he welched on part of the contract. That particular point in time was also the first time that African American athletes started to really resist the way they were treated. You know, there was no more, I'm Jackie Robinson, I'm going to keep my head down, I'm not going to put up with this. And that was because for the first time, a lot of African American athletes were entering football. They were entering football because the AFL recruited at places like Grambling, which the NFL never did.
Right.
Buck Buchanan was the number one draft choice, and he was the first, I believe, the first player drafted in any early round out of Grambling. And we know that over the years, a lot of great football players have come out of Grambling and Prairie View and those other places. So as cities are changing, we have in the late 60s, we had the riots that followed the assassination of Dr. King. We have all this turmoil in the cities. In Oakland, baseball did seem to pull the people together. And that was a city which now, of course, has become quite gentrified, but had just become primarily a predominantly African American city. It was the home of the Black Panthers, Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver, people like that. It was where the school superintendent was murdered by members of the Black Panthers. Oakland was a tough place, and the Raiders had that kind of tough guy image. But the Raiders also were smart that they had, and I don't think Al Davis ever did anything for this reason, but the African-American players they had, they didn't try and muzzle them. They let them say what they wanted to say. And if they felt that the NFL was racist, they let them say it. And they just said, you know, hey, don't, you know, Davis would pull a Belichick. You'd have to talk to Cliff Branch about that. Right. So what this book does, and I think it's really important for those of us who think we know what a rivalry is, you know, it can't be one-sided. And what has strengthened the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry has been the success of the Red Sox in this century, because their success in the previous century was almost non-existent, right? So people could say, well, the Yankees and Red Sox, to the Yankees, it didn't make any difference. Now, to the Yankees, yeah, the Red Sox have won more than they have, and now it's become a big deal to them again. But when we think of rivalries, we think team to team, franchise to franchise. We don't think about city to city. And in this book, the wonderful details of the way the newspapers got involved and went after the other cities. It's really, you don't have to care about the Kansas City Chiefs or the Royals or any of the Oakland teams, but to see the way sports changed in the 60s and 70s and how as sports moved west and the Western teams became more viable, how the dominance of New York and L.A. and Boston and Chicago really went away. They couldn't dominate anymore because there was so much, much more. It's a really, really good book. It's only about 180 pages of text, some very entertaining and very detailed notes, but it's a really good book.
Excellent. And it's called Kansas City versus Oakland, The Better Sports Rivalry That Defined an Era.
The Bitter Sports Rivalry.
That I'm reading it upside down.
Yeah, you're reading it upside down by Michael C. Ehrlich from the University of Illinois Press. It's brand new. Really good book.
Excellent. Thank you, Bruce.
Yep, my pleasure.
And do you know what next week is yet?
Yes, next week we are going to talk about a basketball game which the Soviet Union seemed to get three tries to win.
There we go. And Bruce, Carrie's had a chance to watch it, and so now we've passed on the Ken Burns country music documentary to you to preview before it goes national on September 15th.
I'm really excited. You know, the first thing I did when I looked inside was see the pictures of everybody from the Carter family up to Charlie Pride and thinking, oh, man, this is some good stuff.
Can't wait for that. September 15th, nationwide on PBS, eight nights, 16 and a half hours. Mm. And I saw another piece, I think it was in, it may have been in Time magazine this week, talking about this as the most extensive and thorough music documentary ever made.
I don't see any argument to be made otherwise. It was a trip to watch. Plan your September accordingly, because as soon as you watch the first episode, you're going to want to stick around for all of it.
And as everybody said that we talked to about it, from Ken Burns to Roseanne Cash, Bill Anderson, Kathy Mattea, if you're a country music fan, you'll love it. But if you think you don't like country music, I would challenge you to watch about 15 minutes of this and not come away being a fan of at least some of those country artists.
And it is really the music that is more common to the nation than any other. I mean, Eric, you know, people for years think of country music being from the Southeast. Well, it's country music has been big in the entire United States. And I can't think, you know, more so even, I think, than pop music in a lot of ways, because a lot of people didn't have access to pop music until the 70s.
No, and what it did culturally, the challenges that country music has faced through the culture is being perceived as, and I think someone even refers to it in the series as, you know, the white person's soul music. Mm-hmm. And there's an element of that too. But what you also learn in the series is how much those white country artists were influenced directly by black performers, songwriters, and musicians everywhere, from Johnny Cash to Jimmy Rogers.
Starting with the Carter family.
Yes.
A.P. Carter.
Yep. So yeah. It's great.
And I think it also shows that it is the amalgam of American music. I mean, it's got rhythm and blues in it. It's got soul. It's got old-time country blues. Yeah, I'm really excited to see this.
Well, enjoy it. And we'll talk about it more as we close in on the national debut in mid-September.